God help me, Jessica. I don't know. I just don't know.
Chapter 23. Evan Tucker stared down at the secure email he had read about a dozen times now, and still his mind could not process what it was seeing. Lloyd Carson found murdered in hotel in Romania. Robbery believed to be motive. Tucker looked down at his hands, which were shaking. He tried to type a response, but couldn't manage it. He rose from his desk, crossed his office at Langley, poured himself a glass of water, and drank it down. He poured another, and accidentally splashed some of it down his shirt and tie. He sat back down and peered at the screen. Part of him was hoping that the email had somehow disappeared, or had never been there. Only a delusional byproduct of his overly stressed mind. But there it was. Lloyd Carson, an envoy from Britain to North Korea, had been found murdered. Robbery suspected because his wallet, jewelry, passport, and cell phone had been taken. His cell phone. Tucker made a call and ordered that something be done immediately. It was. Another email soon fell into his inbox and he clicked it open. He thought he might be physically sick. What he was looking at was a list of phone calls made and received by Carson in the hours leading up to his death. The last one had been placed in the wee hours of the morning in Bucharest. It had been placed to a phone number in North Korea, a very special number that only a handful of people had. The question was, had Carson placed that call, or had someone else, like the person who had murdered him? He sent a secure communication at the very top level of secrecy. He did not expect an answer back immediately, and he tried to focus on other work, but found that impossible. There was no other work that came close to this in terms of importance. He couldn't wall off his mind to think of other things. 2 hours later, a reply came back, and it froze him to the bone. A call was received at that time, but no one spoke on the other end. No one spoke on the other end. Tucker played out in his mind what had possibly happened on the ground in Romania. Carson was spooked by something and changed his travel plans on the spot. He made phone calls, all but one to British telephone numbers. One, however, was to North Korea. Whoever had killed him had recognized the country code and simply redialed that number. The person had answered the phone, thinking it was Carson calling again. Tucker leaned his head back against his chair. Did that mean what he thought it meant? Did it matter? He couldn't take that chance. Their ultra-secret operation possibly had just been blown wide open. He had to inform the president. His mind knew he had to do this, but his hand did not move to the phone. He began to rethink things. That phone number was untraceable. Maybe he was okay, just maybe. It might be possible that he need not contact the president. What he needed was to first ensure that the op had not been compromised. And if it hadn't been, he needed to get his team up to speed and into the field so they could execute the op. They would not get a second chance. He made a few more calls, setting in motion this process. Right now, he didn't care if Roby or Real survived or not. He was not overwhelmed by a sense of injustice that demanded they be punished. He simply wanted to survive this. The risk had been huge. Too big, he now lamented. But it was clearly too late for such thinking. He hurried off to a meeting and sat through a presentation that he neither listened to nor cared about. He rushed through a full day of such events, stopping only to eat a cup of soup that felt like acid dropping into his belly. He was driven home and walked into the house. Ordering his aides to remain behind, he sidestepped his wife, who was coming out of the living room to greet him, and fled to the back of the house where his home office was. He engaged the room's SCIF features and checked his emails and voice messages. Nothing yet. That might be good. Or that might be bad. He called Marks at the burner box and told her to speed up the process. It would be Roby and Real, he told her, and they would potentially be deployed very soon. He didn't wait for her to ask questions, but simply hung up. He poured himself a drink of something far stronger than water, and then had another. His nerves were wound so tight the alcohol had no effect at all, and it was like he was drinking a soda. He slumped down in his chair and closed his eyes. He opened them when an alert went off on his computer. That was a very special alert that he had set up, and it demanded immediate attention. His mouth dry and his heart pounding in his chest, Tucker opened the email, which contained the very highest encryption features. The message was brief, but each word was like a bullet fired directly into his skull. He could only stare in disbelief, because whatever hope he had held just a few moments before was now gone. Irreversibly gone. In fact, this surpassed the worst scenario he could have imagined after he'd been informed of Carson's murder. Lloyd Carson was the go-between, the linchpin to this whole thing. And he had been uncovered and targeted, and he had gone down. Well, now they were all going down. But it was even worse than that. This, in fact, changed everything. He picked up his phone and punched in the number. APNSA Potter answered on the second ring. Tucker said, "We're dead. And we're dead beyond belief." Chapter 24. Tick, tick, tick. The old-fashioned wall clock second hand made its way around the timepiece's face. The office Chung Cha sat in was utilitarian, badly maintained and depressing. Well, it would have been depressing for most people. It had no effect on her. She sat there impassively, waiting her turn. As she stared at the clerk in military uniform, who sat at the metal desk next to the door she would at some point pass through, Chung Cha let her mind wander back, far back, but not that far, really, to Yodok, where part of her would always be imprisoned, no matter how far away from it she got. There were teachers there who taught the children basic grammar, a few numbers, and that was about it. As one got older, the instruction became all about the life of labor to come. Chung Cha had commenced work in the mines at age 10, clawing rock from other rock, and being beaten for not making her quotas. In the class, every student was encouraged to snitch on every other student, and Chung Cha was no exception to this. The rewards were meager, though back then they seemed like a mountain of gold. Fewer beatings, a bit more cabbage and salt. Fewer self-censor meetings where students were forced to confess to imaginary sins that they would be beaten for. Chung Cha had gotten to the point where she came to class every day with invented sins to present to the teacher. Because if you had none, the thrashings were twice as painful. It seemed to delight the teachers when students spoke of their weaknesses and the things that made them small, insignificant, less than human. In the camps, the teacher was also your guard, but the only things they taught were cruelty, deceit, and pain. There had been a girl a little older than Chung Cha who had been accused by her parents of stealing a portion of their food. The parents had turned her in after beating her. Chung Cha had come forward because she had seen that it was the parents who had taken food from their child and then blamed her for the crime. Chung Cha's reward for that was to be led into the prison located underneath the camp and hung upside down in a cage where guards continually poked her hour after hour with sword tips heated by a fire. She could smell her skin burning, yet she did not bleed much because the hot metal cauterized the wounds. It was never explained to her why she was punished for telling the truth. When she was finally released and sent back to camp, the girl she had helped snitched on her. For that, Chung Cha was beaten by three guards until she could not move, but just lay on the floor praying to die. They bandaged her wounds, and the next day she was sent into the fields to pick her allotment of crops. When she failed to do so, her father was brought in to beat her, and he did so energetically, for he would be beaten even harder by the guards if he did not. And the other workers spit on her, because the way things worked here was that everyone suffered when one person failed to do his or her job. Every day for a week she was flogged by the guards in the middle of camp for all to see. Prisoners hurled spit and curses at her, and added their own beatings when the flogging was done. When Chung Chai had staggered off after this last session, she had heard one guard say, "She's a tough little bitch." Chung Cha absently rubbed the scars on her arms, where the flamed swords had punctured her. The girl who had snitched on her had died the next month. Chung Cha had lured her to a lonely spot with the promise of a handful of corn, and had pushed her off a cliff. They had not found the body, what was left of it, until that winter. From that day forward, Chung Cha, the tough little bitch, never told the truth again. The door opened and the man looked at her. He was also dressed in a military uniform. He was a high-ranking general. To Chung Cha, they all looked the same, short, wiry, with small, beady eyes and cruel features. They could all be guards at Yodok. Perhaps they all had been. He motioned her in. She rose and followed him into the office. He closed the door and indicated a chair. She took it. He sat behind his metal desk, put his palms together, and studied her. "This is all quite extraordinary, Dong Mu Yi," he said. Dong Mu. That meant comrade. She was his comrade, but not really. She was no one's comrade. Self-reliance. She was her own comrade, that was all. And he clearly did not want her as a comrade. She said nothing in response. It was extraordinary. She could add no more to the statement. And the prison camp had taught her that it was better to say nothing than to say something that you could be beaten for. "He is a respected man," said the general. "He is my great friend." Again, she remained silent, but she kept her gaze directly on him. Normally, a North Korean male would not like that, particularly when faced by a female. But her stare did not waver. She had long ago lost the capacity to fear men like this. She had been hurt physically and psychologically every way she could be. There was nothing left, so there was no reason to fear. The general pulled out the cell phone that she had taken from Lloyd Carson at Bucharest. When she had called the number, last dialed by Carson, General Pak had answered. General Pak was indeed a greatly respected man here. He was in the very inner circle of the Supreme Leader. Some said he was his most trusted advisor. Yet she had recognized the man's voice on the other end of the phone. She had heard him speak. She had met him once in person, though it was many years ago. But she would never forget that meeting. It had definitely been his voice on the phone. She was snitching once more, Chung Cha knew. But that was her job now. The Brit Lloyd Carson had attracted the attention of the North Korean security forces. He had been seen in the company of known American agents. It was well known in North Korea that the Brits and Americans were joined at the hip. She had been assigned to track him, search his things, and, if necessary, kill him as he traveled on his train journey. Well, she had tracked him, searched his things, and killed him. And she had the phone. And they had her testimony that it was General Pak, the respected one, the great friend of the man seated opposite her. It was a delicate situation, she knew. It was a potentially deadly one for her. "The phone number is not traceable. When we call the number, no one answered," said the general. "So we only have your word, Dong Mu Yi, against that of a revered leader." He put the phone down and looked quizzically at her. She finally decided to speak, but chose her words with great care.
"I have made my report. I have told you what I know. I have no more than that to offer."
"And you could not be mistaken about this? About the voice you heard?" Are you absolutely certain? Changsha knew exactly what he wanted to hear. He was not, however, going to hear it from her. He was going to hear something else. She reached into her pocket and slipped out her phone. She hit a few buttons and held it up. She had turned the speaker on. A voice could be heard, clearly speaking in English. Hello?
Hello.
Mr. Carson, is that you?
Hello.
Are you calling back?
Is something wrong?
The general jerked forward in his seat, knocking over a jar of pens sitting on his desk. He looked first at the phone and then at Changsha.
That is General Pak's voice.
She nodded.
Yes.
Where did you get this?
I recorded it when I called the North Korean number from Bucharest.
He banged the desk with his fists.
Why did you not show us this before?
I hoped that you would believe the word of a loyal agent of the Supreme Leader over that of a traitor.
The door opened and two more men came in. They were also generals. It seemed to Changsha that North Korea had far too many generals. These men were outranked by the one sitting across from her. But things like that could change swiftly in her country. Generals came, generals went. They were executed. She had already visited them, let them listen to the phone recording, and then she had come here. The men behind her were too cowardly to face their higher-ranking comrade, so they had sent her in first. The man at the desk rose slowly and stared at them.
What is the meaning of this intrusion?
The Supreme Leader must be told, said one of the other men.
They all well knew that the higher-ranking general was a personal friend of Pak's. This had all been orchestrated because of that fact. The truth in North Korea did not necessarily set one free or cause one to die. It was merely one factor of many that had to be taken into account if your goal was survival.
Do you not agree, General? Asked the other man.
The general looked down at the phone and then up at Changsha's unreadable features. He knew he had just been badly outmaneuvered, and there was absolutely nothing he could do about it. He nodded, took his cap off a hook, and led the two other generals out the door. They simply left Changsha behind. She was not surprised by this. There was no gender equality here. She was not in the military and was thus a second-class citizen to those who were. She wondered if they would send her to kill Pak. She thought the odds were against his simply being executed by firing squad, the normal way of dealing with traitors. It was a tricky balance, she knew, much like the street vendors and the Dutch tourists. Publicly executing Pak would require some explanation. They could lie, of course, but savvier folks would know that only an egregious transgression would justify such a high-ranking official's execution, and the speculation would undoubtedly come to rest on an attempted coup of the Supreme Leader. That such an inner-circle official could have participated in such a scheme would reflect badly on the Supreme Leader. Even though the traitor would have been caught, others might be emboldened to try as well. But traitors had to be dealt with, and execution was usually the only punishment deemed acceptable. So Changsha might be called on to do it, but make it look like an accident, a task she had performed in the past. Thus, the traitor would be dead, and any of his confederates would think twice of trying again. But the public and other potential enemies within the country would not necessarily know of the attempted coup at all. That way, the Supreme Leader would not appear weakened. She thought about all of this, and then thought no more. The order would either come, or it would not. She slipped her phone back into her pocket, rose, and left. A few moments later, she walked out into the sunshine and looked to the sky, where there were no clouds visible. At Yodok, this was the time of year when prisoners knew the cold was coming. The first set of clothes Changsha had received upon entering the camp had come from a dead child. The clothes were filthy and full of holes. She would not receive a new set of rags for 3 years. She labored in a gold mine, digging out the precious metal, unaware of what it was or that it was valuable. She also worked in a gypsum quarry, a distillery, and in the fields. Her day started at 4 in the morning and ended at 11 at night. She had seen clearly insane people forced to dig holes and pull weeds. Dying prisoners were sometimes simply released so their deaths would not be officially reported, thereby making the mortality rates of the camp look better. Chang Cha had not known this was the reason. She only remembered old and young prisoners dragging themselves through the open gates only to expire meters from the spot, their bodies left to decompose or be eaten by animals. She had lived with 30 other prisoners in a mud hut not much bigger than her current apartment. The huts were unheated and the blankets threadbare. She had suffered frostbite while inside the hut. She had awoken to find the person next to her dead of the cold. There was one toilet for 200 prisoners. To the outside world, this probably seemed unimaginable. For Chang Cha, it was simply her life. 10. 10 was the number of basic rules at all the camps. The first and most important was, you must not escape. The last and nearly as important was, if you break any of the above rules, you will be shot. All the rules in between, no stealing, obey all orders, spy on and betray other prisoners, were just filler, she believed. The fact was they could kill you for any reason or no reason at all. Rule number 9 had intrigued her, however. It said that one must truly be remorseful for one's mistakes. She knew this was an incentive for those who hoped one day to be free of the camps. She had never hoped this. She never believed she would be free. She was not remorseful for her mistakes. She was simply trying to survive. In that regard, her life now was no different from her life in the camp. I am simply trying to survive. Chapter 25. The three men were in the White House Situation Room again. And once more, the NSC watch teams had been walled off. There were no recordings being made. There were no other attendees. No official transcript would be kept. Evan Tucker looked at the president, and the president stared back at him. The latter had not been told why this meeting had been called, only that it was urgent and needed to take place immediately. That was why they were sitting here now, and why the president had canceled 4 meetings that he had been scheduled to attend. "Care to take me out of the dark, Evan?" the president said in a clearly annoyed tone. Josh Potter had already met with Tucker and thus knew what was coming. He had been uncomfortable not informing the president directly since he was the president's man. But Tucker had browbeat him into letting the DCI make the briefing. And in truth, Potter did not want to be the messenger on this debacle. Tucker cleared his throat, which lately had felt like mold was growing there. He clasped his hands together and rubbed his 2 thumbs against one another so hard they turned bright pink. "There have been developments of a critical nature related to the mission, and none of them are good." All the color seemed to drain from the president's face. He barked, "Explain that!" Tucker said, "As you know, Lloyd Carson was the British envoy assigned to the embassy in Pyongyang. He has been our chief go-between with General Pak, really our only go-between." The president said, "And I was initially incredulous. He should have gone to his own government with this. Then my esteemed colleague at 10 Downing Street could have dealt with it. And as I explained, Carson was well aware that no one in his country would have the stomach to follow this through. So with his leader's blessings, he presented the opportunity to us." The president closed his eyes, his top row of teeth clamping onto his bottom lip. When he opened his eyes, his look was one of fury. "It always falls to us, doesn't it? The good old USA, the world's policemen, will do the dirty work while everyone else stays safely on the sidelines. And if things go to hell, feel free to turn on us or simply run away. Tucker nodded and said, "Superpower status carries great responsibility, and much of it is unfair. But the fact remains we did follow it up because we saw a tremendous opportunity to get rid of a regime that has been a thorn in the civilized world's side for decades. We knew there were risks, and we all felt that the benefits outweighed them." "Save the cover-your-ass speech, Evan," snapped the president. "And tell me what happened." Tucker sat back and composed himself. The president had read him exactly right. That was his CYA speech, but at least he had said it. Lloyd Carson apparently got on the radar of the North Korean state security people. How? The entire country is one huge pool of paranoia where everyone spies on everyone else, sir. That's built into their psyche from the cradle. It truly is like Orwell's novel. So he got on their radar. Then what? Said the president tersely. He was traveling outside the country. He had stops along the way, so he flew to Istanbul and boarded the Orient Express that would take him first to Eastern Europe and then on to Western Europe, ending in Venice. But he didn't finish his ride. He apparently felt compromised in Romania and got off. He went to a hotel. In his room there, he was attacked and killed. "My God!" exclaimed the president. And then he waited for Tucker to continue. Apparently, he had called a number shortly before he was murdered. Whose number? General Pax. It was a special phone, untraceable. All right. Now, what exactly is the problem? Said the president, looking puzzled. Apparently, their agent called the number. General Pax, thinking it was Carson, answered. And the agent recognized his voice. Shit! Roared the president. Are you serious, Tucker? That's how it went down? He slumped back in his chair, his eyes closed once more. Tucker and Potter exchanged anxious glances. Each man was probably thinking about what his next career might be. Certainly it would be outside government. Without opening his eyes, the president said, And if Carson was murdered and no one other than us knew about this mission, how did we learn about all this? Tucker knew the question was coming, and he had prepared many answers, some longer than others. He had decided the shortest response would be the best. General Pack, when he learned that Carson had been murdered, he immediately recognized his mistake in answering the phone and reported to us. The president opened his eyes. So what exactly does North Korea intend to do?
Well, this is only conjecture, but I imagine that they intend to tell the world what the plot was.
That Western powers were planning to assassinate their supreme leader and install General Pak as the new leader. And even though Carson was a Brit, the term Western powers would obviously include us.
And who would believe that?
Well, we've done it before, pointed out Tucker, in other countries. But not for a long time, replied the president. That's why there's a law now that... He broke off and muttered, shit, again. Great Britain is our closest ally. No one would believe they would act without us on something like this, added Potter. They will torture Pack and his family until he tells all he knows, said Tucker. He will have details, facts that will substantiate his position. He will tell them of the video conference here, where you gave him your word. The president slammed his fist against the tabletop. Don't throw that in my face, Tucker. This is your screw-up and yours only.
I absolutely agree with you, sir.
Only what? Snapped the president. Potter spoke, perhaps feeling that as the president's advisor he needed to, well, advise. Only the ultimate blame will fall to you, sir, he said in an apologetic tone. The president put a hand to his face and said, Harry Truman, right? Buck stops here. Potter nodded and eyed Tucker severely. Unfair, sir, but true. The DCI won't be the main target. You will. The president opened his eyes and looked at Tucker. We certainly hoped for better, sir, said Tucker lamely. The president sighed and said resignedly, So they tell the world, all right. They torture Pack and he gives them ammo for it. All right, I guess we wait and counterpunch when the blow comes. Do we know what the timing will be? I assume they already have Pack in custody. He's not in North Korea, answered Tucker. The president shot him a glance. What? He left North Korea both on official business and because of a medical condition that needed tending to, and which he felt foreign doctors were better suited to treat. Because of his position within the leadership, he was able to do that. Whoa, where the hell is he? Sputtered the president, evidently still trying to process all of this. He's in France. But with what the North Koreans know, won't he already be under arrest there? He would have been, except he has unofficially left his entourage and is now in hiding. Why the hell didn't you tell me this before? Because I needed you to fully understand the situation, sir, before I started to present possible solutions. Potter spoke up. If he's in hiding and not under North Korean arrest, why don't we simply go get him and put him in hiding permanently? With what explanation? Asked Tucker. The president said, Why the need for explanation at all? They don't have to know that we have him. Then they'll simply release publicly that we attempted to use PAC to overthrow the government in violation of both international law and our own laws, and that we are now harboring him and granting him asylum in the United States. And they won't have a shred of proof. Sir, they do not deal in fact. But consider this. If they do make the allegations, it will stir up a lot of attention. As you said, Carson was a Brit. That will entangle our allies in London. He'll go missing in France. Our Paris colleagues will be targeted. No one will believe that they acted without the United States. The media will have a field day. They will leave no stone unturned. Questions will be asked, answers will have to be given, and if the truth comes out? He looked at both Potter and the president. I personally do not want to go to prison over this. The president jerked to his feet, put his hands in his pockets, and began to pace, agitation all over his features. I can't believe this situation. I really cannot believe that I allowed myself to be put in this untenable, bullshit position. I think we must remain calm and think this through, said Potter, though his face was very pale. The president stopped pacing and looked derisively at his aide. Easy for you to say, Josh. Your participation in this will amount to no more than a stupid footnote in history. I'll take the major hit. I'll be the president in disgrace. Potter's face turned bright red. Of course, sir. I did not mean to imply otherwise. The president held up his hand and dropped into his seat. Just don't, he said wearily. He looked at Tucker. So, what are you proposing? Tucker took a moment to compose his reply while the president and Potter watched him closely. I propose that we target and kill General Pack while he is in France, and then blame it on the North Koreans. The president gaped. Kill him? But I gave the man my word, Tucker broke in. That was then, and this is now. And besides, I blame Pack for this. He must have known Carson was compromised. He never should have answered the damn phone. He screwed up. And when you screw up, you pay the price. He looked at both men. Well, he said breathlessly, this is the price. His death? His murder? Said the president. How does that help us? Asked Potter. Power struggles occur in North Korea all the time. There was a recent assassination attempt on Un that failed. We can tie all that to Pak and wrap it up neatly. With that as an alternative explanation, and with the help of our allies, I believe we can effectively turn this around and throw it right in their faces. We can argue that they're blaming us for something they did. general and blanket denials without the need to get into specifics that might come back to haunt us, all based on Pak as the scapegoat. The president was about to say something and then stopped as he continued to mull this over. Neither Potter nor Tucker seemed inclined to break the silence. "This is a choice that would befuddle Solomon," the president said at last. "A choice between awful and terrible."
"Yes, sir," agreed Tucker.
"If we do what you propose, it must be now. I have my team in place. They can be deployed at once." The president cast him a sharp glance.
"Roby and Reel?"
Tucker nodded.
"Roby and Reel."
More silence passed. Finally, Tucker said, "Sir, have you made a decision?" The president didn't speak right away. When he did, his voice was weak and resigned. "I really can't believe this is happening, but it is. We've gone far enough down this road that there's no turning back."
"I'm afraid not."
"Well, at least we didn't start a war, right? No American has died." His face was ashen as he said this.
"Not yet," muttered Potter under his breath.
"No, sir," replied Tucker firmly. The president rose, and without looking at Tucker, he said, "Do what you have to do. And when this is all over, start thinking about a career outside of my administration, Tucker. You're done." Then he walked out of the room. Chapter 26. They waited. They had been waiting for some time now. Reel looked at Roby, and he glanced back at her. Then both their gazes turned to the door, which was opening. They had expected to see D.D. Mark standing there, and were startled when, instead, it was DCI Evan Tucker. He strode briskly in with an air of calm and authority. He unbuttoned his suit coat, sat down, and opened the bottle of water waiting for him there. He turned to see an aide who had walked in with him.
"Coffee."
He looked at Roby and Reel.
"You two want anything to drink?"
Reel shook her head, her lips pursed, her arms folded in front of her. Roby said, "No, thanks." Tucker waited for the aide to bring the coffee and leave, closing the door behind her. Then he turned to them after taking a sip. "I understand that you both made it through the burner box with flying colors," he said pleasantly. "Congratulations."
"Does that mean we're done?"
asked Reel. Tucker seemed surprised by this. "Didn't the DD tell you?"
"She said a mission was coming up and things had to be sped up," answered Roby, while Reel simply stared at the DCI.
"Well, I might not have been entirely clear with her," conceded Tucker.
"And why isn't she in this meeting?" asked Roby.
"She runs the ops."
"She doesn't run all the ops," corrected Tucker. "I'm the DCI."
"So what's the mission?" asked Roby.
"Yes, what is the mission, Director?"
asked Reel pointedly. Tucker took another swig of his coffee, uncapped the water, and took a drink from that, too. Both Roby and Reel saw the beads of sweat on his forehead, although the room was very chilly.
"I wanted to tell you personally," began Tucker. "Heightened rules of secrecy will apply to this."
"So high the DD isn't in the loop?"
asked Reel.
Tucker licked his lips.
"I didn't say that."
"So who is the target?" asked Roby.
Tucker indicated computer screen panels built into the table in front of them. He hit some keys on his panel, and the screens in front of Roby and Reel came to life. They looked down at them and saw a photo of a man there. Tucker said,
"His name is General Pak Chin-hai. He is Vice Marshal, Chief of the North Korean Army's General Staff, and he helps run the Central Military Committee, arguably the most powerful body in the country."
"And he's the target?" asked Roby. "Why?"
"You don't have to know why, Roby," snapped Tucker. "Have you learned nothing while you've been at the burner? You follow orders. You don't do analysis. Your job is to pull the trigger, not question those who tell you to do so."
A few moments of silence passed before Tucker said, I'm sorry. We're all under a lot of pressure. We need to work together. Just be assured that this target has to be eliminated. It's in the national security interests of this country. Roby looked over at Real. She said,
Okay, he has to die. Does this mean we go to North Korea? If so, how do we get in and how do we get out? Or is that not in the game plan, meaning the getting out part?
Tucker cleared his throat. I understand the concerns you might have after Syria. That's good to hear, sir, replied Roby. But I met with you before to assure you that this is not personal. This mission is for the greater good. Nothing gets in the way of that.
So where is the target?
Asked Real again. The target will not be in North Korea.
Where, then?
He's currently in France. He traveled there for a medical procedure. The hit will take place there. A medical issue, and he went to France? Pondered Roby. Why not China or Russia? They're buddies with Pyongyang. I really didn't bother to find out why, said Tucker curtly. And hitting him in either of those places would have been far more problematic and perhaps resulted in dangerous international turmoil.
We're taking out basically the number two guy in North Korea, and you don't think there'll be international turmoil?
Said Real incredulously. We're not going to announce that it's us, for God's sake, said Tucker. We're not the only enemies that North Korea has. There's a long list, actually, and that cover, I think, will be enough. He added, We're going to lay the blame elsewhere. You might very well lay it at the feet of North Korea itself. Un has many internal enemies. It's not a stretch to think one of them could have plotted against him and he took his revenge. No one will find out we did it. When is all this taking place? Asked Roby. Tucker took another sip of coffee and fiddled with the top of his bottled water. You leave tonight. Roby and Real both stared at him incredulously. Tucker finally lifted his gaze to meet theirs. I understand that it's not the usual amount of time for an op like this. It's not even close, actually, said Roby. The SEALs did Bin Laden on short notice, the DCI pointed out. The target site there had been under eyes for a long time. There were plans. The squad was coptered in, they hit hard and fast, there was no cover-up or finger-pointing. We wanted the world to know we'd done it, Roby responded. What you're asking from us is far more challenging. Yes, I admit that is a difference, said Tucker. What sort of support will we have from the locals? Asked Roby. None, said Tucker. You're going in naked.
And the exit plan?
Said Real.
You never really addressed that.
There is an exit plan. You're sure about that? Asked Roby.
And with no local help?
Real added. Tucker's features darkened. You managed to get out of Syria and back home without the benefit of any local help, he barked, momentarily losing his temper. He took another gulp of water and wiped his face. And the margin of error there was so narrow as to be non-existent, said Roby. We hoped for better this time around. There will be assets there to help you, our assets. We will get you out, that I promise. Real leaned forward and studied him.
And why the change of heart, Director? You go from waterboarding us to try and get a signed confession to being concerned for our personal welfare.
I already explained that to you, Tucker said in an exasperated tone. More calmly, he added, things have changed. Real sat back.
Yes, I think they have. This isn't the original mission you'd envisioned. Something happened. And now we're being sent in to clean up a mess.
She leaned forward again.
So what was the original mission?
I have no idea what you're talking about, replied Tucker.
Sure you do. It's as plain as the spooked look in your eyes and the beads of sweat on your forehead.
She paused and added,
Does the president know?
Tucker rose and gripped his coffee. You'll receive training briefs in a few minutes. Once you get to France, you will do a practice scenario and come up to speed on every aspect of the op. You will do the hit, and you will return home. He paused. You do that, he said, staring directly at Real, and all will be forgiven. Real stood too and looked directly back at him.
That's very nice, Director. Only I don't remember asking for your forgiveness.
Chapter 27 Earl Fontaine rolled over in his bed and looked at the man opposite him.
"Hey, Junior," he said. "Junior! Junior, wake your ass up!"
Junior finally stirred and looked over at him.
"What?" he said dully. "Here are your butts going back to death row today." "Huh? Where'd you hear that, old man?" "Keep my ears open. Don't just sleep all day like you do. You gotta enjoy life, boy, while you can. Pretty soon, all you'll be doing is sleeping 6 feet under the ground with mold growing on you."
Junior snorted.
"Being cremated, dumbass. They gonna sprinkle your asses where you come from? Which outhouse is that, Junior?"
Junior rattled his chain ominously.
"You're lucky I'm over here and you're over there."
"Guess so. Don't want you to shit on me like you've been doing on yourself."
Junior grinned.
"Know me something, old man."
Earl returned the smile.
"What's that? How to count to 10?
"You know what I'm talking about. The doc. And that load of bullshit you laying on her."
"Don't know what you talking about, boy."
"Your daughter, huh? Bet you ain't got no daughter."
"Sure I do, son, sure I do. I'm thinking you got something up and I need to talk to somebody."
Earl sat up.
"Is that right? You gonna talk to somebody? What you gonna say?"
Junior absently scratched his chin.
"Now, I've been thinking on that. I've been thinking, what could Earl Fontaine and his fat ass be up to?"
"And what'd your little pea brain say back to you, huh?"
"It says to me that Earl Fontaine got some scam going. He wants to get somebody down here to see him for some reason ain't nobody but him knows about."
"Damn, son, you good. You real good."
"Yes, I am," said Junior firmly.
"But who you gonna tell who believe your ass? They're killing you pretty damn soon. You're nothing to them but some statistic. One more asshole with a number they make and leave this here world. So long, Alabama. I say my piece with the doc. Women? I can be pretty damn convincing."
"I bet you can."
Earl rubbed his chin and looked thoughtful.
"Yes, sir, I bet you damn sure can. Sure, I can see that. Hell, you like that movie star. What's his name? Brad Pitt. Gals throw their underwear at that boy.
So soon as I see her again, she gonna hear from me.
But you going back to death row before she comes back. So's I tell me somebody else, or I tell her, come see me in there. I believe you would, I do indeed."
Earl looked over and saw the man enter the ward. He gazed back at Junior.
"Maybe we can make some kind of deal, Junior."
"Maybe you can go to hell, Earl."
"Is that your final word, son?"
"No. Go to hell twice."
"Damn, son. What's that under your sheet?"
"What?
Under your sheet, boy. What's that thing I see there?"
Junior put his hand under his sheet, and his fingers closed around it. He slowly withdrew it, looking stunned.
"He's got a knife!" screamed Earl. "He's gonna kill somebody! Knife! Knife!"
Others in the ward looked over and started yelling. A nurse overturned her tray. Another patient started yelling. Someone hit an alarm.
Junior said, "Wait! I ain't know where this..."
He looked up into the immense face of Albert, the guard.
"Wait!"
screamed Junior, as he started to drop the knife. Albert clamped his hand over Junior's, keeping the knife right where it was. He seemed to be struggling with Junior for the weapon. Then Albert's baton came down once, twice, and then a third time on Junior's head. Each impact sounded like a melon being hit with a hammer. The first blow knocked Junior out. The second blow clearly killed him. The third blow was just because Albert wanted to. Albert let go and the knife clattered to the floor.
Junior slid halfway off his bed. His body was held there by the chain bolted to the wall.
Albert took a step back and looked at the blood, hair, and brain matter on his baton. He used Junior's sheet to wipe it off. He looked around and said,
"It's okay. He's not gonna hurt nobody no more."
He looked back at Junior.
"Dumb son of a bitch."
"Holy Lord, Albert, you done saved us all," said Earl. "No telling what that crazy man was gonna do with that there blade."
"All he's gonna do now is nothing,"
said Albert with finality.
He looked over at Earl, and a glimmer of a smile crossed his lips. To everyone, he said,
"I'll report this here incident. Everybody saw what happened, right?"
Earl nodded his head vigorously.
"I sure as hell did. Maniac was trying to kill us with that there knife. Saw it clear as day. He knows his ass is gonna get lethal injected. Probably wanted to take as many of us with him as he could. Bastard ain't got nothing to lose. Can't execute him twice, right?"
"Right," said Albert.
He surveyed the room again.
"Right."
Everyone in the room, from the prisoners to the staff, nodded back. Albert smiled and looked satisfied.
"We're good then. I get the boys come get this pile of trash. Least now, we don't have to spend the money to execute his sorry ass."
He turned and walked off. Earl settled back against his pillow, trying hard to hide his smile as he stared over at the dead Junior. The same male nurse who had chastised Earl for wanting to smoke while hooked to oxygen came over to him.
"Damn," said the nurse. "Where the hell did Junior get that knife?"
Earl slowly shook his head.
"No telling. You better count your scalpels and all that stuff. Son of a bitch probably took it from one of you.
But he's chained to a wall. And what was he going to do with it?"
"Wait till somebody got close and take him hostage, I bet you," said Earl. "They're going to kill his ass. He wants out of here. Last chance, right?"
"Damn, talk about your evil scum."
"That's right,"
said Earl, as he puffed up his pillow and lay back, still watching Junior's blood drip down the sheets.
"Talk about your evil scum. Trying to beat the hangman, that sumbitch, after all the shit he done pulled in his sorry-ass life. Good riddance, I say."
"What is the world coming to?" said the nurse.
"It's coming," thought Earl. "It's coming, all right. It's coming right to me."
An investigation crew came in and took some pictures and did some forensic analysis, but everyone in the ward could tell their hearts were hardly in it. A man who had committed vile murders and was scheduled to be executed for these crimes had tried to kill people with a stolen knife. Then he'd had his brains bashed in by a heroic prison guard for his troubles. They couldn't have cared less. Later, Earl watched as a prison crew came in and took Junior away, and then cleaned up the area. Earl kept his gaze on the black body bag until it disappeared out the door. Then he closed his eyes and grinned. Under his breath, he said,
"Nighty-night, Junior."
Chapter 28. The dawn was breaking cool and clear when they landed at a private airstrip outside of Avignon in France. Clearing customs was not a problem. They simply bypassed it. When you arrived on clandestine wings on soil governed by an ally, conveniences like that tended to occur. Roby and Rio carried duffels off the jet and dumped them in a truck waiting for them on the tarmac. Rio took the wheel, while Roby rode shotgun. After their meeting with Evan Tucker, they had geared up and game-planned as much as was possible in the few hours they had to do so. They had spent the flight time going over various scenarios. As they drove along, Rio rolled down her window and let the breeze wash over her face. Neither had slept the entire trip except for a 45-minute catnap right before landing.
So,
she said, breaking the silence. Roby turned on the radio, on the off chance that there was a bug somewhere in their vehicle. General Pack, said Roby.
Tucker screwed up big time somewhere. I could see it in his sweat, the chicken shit.
North Korean general goes down in France. I wonder who the original target was. She glanced at him.
We both know that, don't we?
Roby looked out the window. The countryside in the south of France was beautiful much of the year. While the lavender wasn't as vibrant right now as it was in the summer, it was still something to look at. But for Roby, it might as well have been a dead cacti. He said, Blue Man thought it was a head of state, and Blue Man is almost always right.
So for North Korea, that means the supreme leader, Kim Jong-un.
But he's no longer the target.
And General Pak is,
she noted.
So what changed?
General Pak is the second in command over there. You think he was behind a coup orchestrated by us? She nodded, tapping her fingers on the steering wheel as she did so.
It certainly happens. Military wants to take over. We work with them and turn an enemy into an ally.
Coups work when they're a surprise. My take is something happened to blow up the surprise. Real said,
You think the president signed off on the hit on Pak?
Roby nodded. Not even Evan Tucker has the balls to authorize this alone. She said,
Mission got screwed. Blowback could be a tsunami. And all thanks to Evan Tucker and his megalomaniac plans. And we get called in to clean up his mess. And he walks in to meet us with a smile on his face like he didn't try to drown a confession out of us. And we're suddenly best friends. I knew the guy was an asshole. This just confirms it.
Roby slipped the gun from his holster and examined it. The pistol was his old reliable. He'd used it in dozens of missions. It was lightweight, compact, had perfectly aligned iron sights, and fit his hand precisely. It was a beautiful piece of customized engineering, with a ton of blood symbolically coated on its metal and polymer skin. Rio glanced at him again.
Having second thoughts?
He looked at her. And you're not? Real didn't respond to this. She just stared down the road and kept driving. Roby and Real spent the day preparing for the targeted hit, including a reconnaissance visit to the cottage Pak was renting. They ate a late lunch in their hotel room overlooking the valley steeped in the colors of fall. Real went to the window with her cup of coffee and looked out. Roby remained at the table, going over the details one more time. He said, You got it down?
Every millimeter and microsecond.
She replied. Real added,
You ever think of living in a place like this when all is said and done?
He rose and joined her at the window, following her gaze. She turned to him.
Have you?
I told you once before I don't look that far down the road.
And I told you once before you should start.
He glanced over her shoulder. Peaceful. Pretty.
Go to market with your basket and get your food fresh for that day. Take walks, ride bicycles, sit outside at a cafe and just do nothing.
You sound like an ad for a travel magazine, he said, smiling.
Why shouldn't I have something like that?
No reason in the world, he said, turning serious at her response. You can have it. She looked wistfully out the window for a few seconds more and then turned to him with a resigned smile.
The hell I can. Let's get back to work.
Night came, and then the deepest dark of night arrived hours later. They set out from their hotel and made a circuitous journey to their final destination. It was a cottage on the outskirts of a cliff-hanging village about 30 kilometers south of Avignon. The property was wooded and isolated. There was no car in front when Roby and Rio reached the edge of the tree line and peered at the structure through their night optics. You think this is a setup? He said.
I've been thinking that ever since we went wheels up stateside.
Me too. He went to the rear. She started toward the front. During the earlier recon of the target site, They had left behind motion-triggered cameras on all sides of the property, and also pointed at the front and rear of the house. They had checked all these images on their tablet on the drive over. The cameras had captured nothing other than the occasional squirrel and bird. No humans. No movement from anyone into or out of the cottage. Roby cleared the back door, at the same time Reel cleared the front window. He wasn't guessing about this. They were calmed and kept each other informed of their movements and locations. The last thing they wanted was to kill each other, by mistake. They cleared the few rooms of the cottage and met in the back hall. There was only one room left to go, probably a bedroom. They both could hear movement, slight movement, in that room. They raised their guns, fingers slipped to triggers. Reel touched Roby.
"I'll do the kill shot,"
she whispered. "Why?" he whispered back.
"Because I'm the only reason you're in this mess,"
she replied. They silently made their way to the door. Roby covered her while Reel nudged it open with her foot. The light inside the room came on. They were ready for this. Their optics automatically adjusted to the increased level of illumination. The old man sat in his undershorts and white t-shirt on the edge of the bed. His feet were in slippers with white socks on them. His hair was perfectly combed and his manner calm. His uniform with the stars was neatly draped over the arm of a chair next to the bed. His cap was on the seat of the chair. These observations were quickly forgotten. Both Roby's and Reel's attention was drawn to the gun in his hand. They both took aim, but firing became unnecessary. He said in clearly articulated English, "Don't let them hurt my family, and tell your president to go to hell." Then the old man stuffed the gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. Chapter 29. Roby sipped on a cup of lukewarm coffee and studied the other people in the small room. They were in a CIA safe house 20 kilometers outside of Paris. Reel was there, leaning against the wall and staring at nothing. DD Amanda Marks was reading something on her phone. Andrew Viola sat in a chair, his gaze on the floor. Eva Tucker was in another chair and staring at the ceiling. Marks finished with her phone and looked at Roby and Reel.
"Anything to add to your debrief?"
Roby shook his head, and Reel said,
"No. He obviously knew we were coming, and he shot himself before we could. He said not to let them hurt his family, and he told the president to go to hell."
Evan Tucker seemed to shudder with every word she spoke. Reel looked at him with disgust, but said nothing. Roby put down the coffee and rose. "You want to tell us what's really going on now?" His question was directed not at Marks, but at Tucker. The DCI slowly seemed to realize this by the silence that persisted. He looked up to see Roby staring at him. "And what the hell do you mean by that?" Tucker said slowly. "I mean I'd like to hear the truth." Roby took a few steps toward the man. Reel did the same. Viola rose and stood between the DCI and them. "I think we all need to take a breath and calm down." Mark said,
"Roby and Reel, you need to stand down on this. The mission is over."
Reel glanced at her.
"I highly doubt that."
"What do you mean?" snapped Tucker.
"The second in command in North Korea just offs himself in France, and you think it ends here?"
"The whole scene has been cleansed," said Tucker. "There's nothing tying us to this. He killed himself, that's clear. When the body is found, that's what the verdict will be, because it's the truth."
"You're joking, right?"
said Reel.
"You think the North Koreans, the paranoid North Koreans, who desperately want to be